and Helmut or Ahmet. Oxytocin, the love hormone, makes us more pro-social to us and worse to everyone else. That's not generic pro-sociality, that's ethnocentrism and xenophobia. In other words, the actions of these neuropeptides depend dramatically on context, who you are, your environment, and who that person is. As we will see in Chapter 8, the same applies to the regulation of genes relevant to these neuropeptides. The endocrinology of aggression in females. Help. This topic confuses me. Here's why. This is a domain where the ratios of two hormones can matter more than their absolute levels, where the brain responds the same way to A, 2 units of estrogen plus 1 unit of progesterone, and B, 2 gazillion units of estrogen plus 1 gazillion units of progesterone. This requires some complex neurobiology. Hormone levels are extremely dynamic, with 100-fold changes in some within hours. No male's testes ever had to navigate the endocrinology of ovulation or childbirth. Among other things, recreating such endocrine fluctuations in lab animals is tough. There's dizzying variability across species. Some breed year-round, others only in particular seasons. Nursing inhibits ovulation in some, stimulates it in others. Progesterone rarely works in the brain as itself. Instead, it's usually converted into various neurosteroids, with differing actions in different brain regions. And estrogen describes a soup of related hormones, none of which work identically. Finally, one must debunk the myth that females are always nice and affiliative, unless, of course, they're aggressively protecting their babies, which is cool and inspirational. Maternal aggression. Levels of aggression rise in rodents during pregnancy, peaking around parturition. Appropriately, the highest levels occur in species and breeds with the greatest threat of infanticide. During late pregnancy, estrogen and progesterone increase maternal aggression by increasing oxytocin release in certain brain regions, bringing us back to oxytocin promoting maternal aggression. Two complications illustrate some endocrine principles. Estrogen contributes to maternal aggression, but estrogen can also reduce aggression and enhance empathy and emotional recognition. It turns out there are two different types of receptors for estrogen in the brain, mediating these opposing effects and with their levels independently regulated. Thus, same hormone, same levels, different outcome if the brain is set up to respond differently. The other complication. As noted, progesterone, working with estrogen, promotes maternal aggression. However, on its own, it decreases aggression and anxiety. Same hormone, same levels, diametrically opposite outcomes depending on the presence of a second hormone. Progesterone decreases anxiety through a thoroughly cool route. When it enters neurons, it is converted to another steroid. This binds to GABA receptors, making them more sensitive to the inhibitory effects of GABA, thereby calming the brain. Thus, direct crosstalk between hormones and neurotransmitters. Bare-knuckled female aggression. The traditional view is that other than maternal aggression, any female-female competition is passive, covert. As noted by the pioneering primatologist Sarah Blaffer Hurdy of the University of California at Davis, before the 1970s, hardly anyone even researched competition among females. Nevertheless, there is plenty of female-female aggression. This is often dismissed with a psychopathology argument. If, say, a female chimp is murderous, it's because, well, she's crazy. Or female aggression is viewed as endocrine spillover. Females synthesize small amounts of androgens in the adrenals and ovaries. In the spillover view, the process of synthesizing real female steroid hormones is somewhat sloppy, and some androgenic steroids are inadvertently produced, since evolution is lazy and hasn't eliminated androgen receptors in female brains, there's some androgen-driven aggression. These views are wrong for a number of reasons. Female brains don't contain androgen receptors simply because they come from a similar blueprint as male brains. Instead, androgen receptors are distributed differently in the brains of females and males, with higher levels in some regions in females. There has been active selection for androgen effects in females. Even more important, female aggression makes sense. Females can increase their evolutionary fitness with strategic, instrumental aggression. Depending on the species, females compete aggressively for resources, e.g. food or nesting places, harass lower-ranking reproductive competitors into stress-induced infertility, or kill each other's infants, as in chimps. And in the bird, and rare primate species, where males are actually paternal, females compete aggressively for such princes. Remarkably, there are even species, primates, bonobos, lemurs, marmosets, and tamarins, rock hyraxes, and rodents, the California mouse, Syrian golden hamsters, and naked mole rats, where females are socially dominant and more aggressive, and often more muscular than males. The most celebrated example of a sex reversal system is the spotted hyena, shown by Lawrence Frank of UC Berkeley and colleagues. Among typical social carnivores, e.g. lions, females do most of the hunting, after which males show up and eat first. Among hyenas, it's the socially subordinate males who hunt. They are then booted off the kill by females so that the kids eat first. Get this. In many mammals, erections are a sign of dominance, of a guy strutting his stuff. Among hyenas, it's reversed. When a female is about to terrorize a male, he gets an erection. Please don't hurt me. Look, I'm just a non-threatening male. Footnote. Think about this. Among typical mammals, when males are terrified, they lose erections. Among hyenas, that's when they get one. And when some moth-eaten male has the chance to mate, he's probably terrified out of his mind. This implies some very different wiring of the autonomic nervous system, whereby stress promotes rather than inhibits erections. What explains female competitive aggression in sex reversal species or normal animals? Those androgens in females are obvious suspects, and in some sex reversal species, females have androgen levels that equal or even trump those in males. Among hyenas, where this occurs, spending fetal life awash in mom's plentiful androgens produces a pseudo-hermaphrodite. Female hyenas have a fake scrotal sac, no external vagina, and a clitoris that is as large as a penis and gets erect as well. Moreover, some of the sex differences in the brain seen in most mammals don't occur in hyenas or naked mole rats, reflecting their fetal androgenization. This suggests that elevated female aggression in sex reversal species arises from the elevated androgen exposure and, by extension, that the diminished aggression among females of other species comes from their low androgen levels. But complications emerge. For starters, there are species, e.g. Brazilian guinea pigs, where females have high androgen levels but aren't particularly aggressive or dominant toward males. Conversely, there are sex reversal bird species without elevated androgen levels in females. Moreover, as with males, individual levels of androgens in females, whether in conventional or sex reversal species, do not predict individual levels of aggression. And most broadly, androgen levels don't tend to rise around periods of female aggression. This makes sense. Female aggression is mostly related to reproduction and infant survival, maternal aggression, obviously, but also female competition for mates, nesting places, and much-needed food during pregnancy or lactation. Androgens disrupt aspects of reproduction and maternal behavior in females. As emphasized by Hurdy, females must balance the pro-aggression advantages of androgens with their anti-reproductive disadvantages. Ideally, then, androgens in females should affect the aggression parts of the brain, but not the reproduction/maternalism parts, which is precisely what has evolved, as it turns out. Paramenstrual aggression and irritability. Inevitably, we turn to premenstrual syndrome, PMS, the symptoms of negative mood and irritability that come around the time of menstruation, along with the bloating of water retention, cramps, acne. There's a lot of baggage and misconceptions about PMS, along with PMDD, premenstrual dysphoric disorder, where symptoms are severe enough to impair normal functioning. It affects 2 to 5% of women. The topic is mired in two controversies. What causes PMS / PMDD? And how is it relevant to aggression? The first is a doozy. Is PMS / PMDD a biological disease or a social construct? In the extreme, it's just a social construct school. PMS is entirely culture-specific, meaning it occurs only in certain societies. Margaret Mead started this by asserting in 1928 in Coming of Age in Samoa that Samoan women don't have mood or behavioral changes when menstruating. Since the Samoans were enshrined by Mead as the coolest, most peaceful, and sexually free primates east of bonobos, this started trendy anthropological claims that women in other hip, minimal clothing cultures had no PMS either. And naturally, cultures with rampant PMS, e.g. American primates, were anti-Samoans, where symptoms arose from mistreatment and sexual repression of women. This view even had room for a socioeconomic critique, with howlers like, PMS is a mode for the expression of women's anger resulting from her oppressed position in American capitalist society. An offshoot of this view is the idea that in such repressive societies, it's the most repressed women who have the worst PMS. Thus, depending on the paper, women with bad PMS must be anxious, depressed, neurotic, hypochondriacal, sexually repressed, toadies of religious repression, or more compliant with gender stereotypes and must respond to challenge by withdrawing rather than by tackling things head-on. In other words, not a single cool Samoan among them. Fortunately, this has mostly subsided. Numerous studies show normal shifts in the brain and behavior over the course of the reproductive cycle, with as many behavioral correlates of ovulation as of menses. PMS, then, is simply a disruptively extreme version of those shifts. While PMS is real, symptoms vary by culture. For example, paramenstrual women in China report less negative affect than do Western women, raising the issue of whether they experience less and or report less. Given the more than 100 symptoms linked to PMS, it's not surprising if different symptoms predominate in different populations. As strong evidence that paramenstrual mood and behavioral changes are biological, they occur in other primates. Both female baboons and female vervet monkeys become more aggressive and less social before their menses, without, to my knowledge, having issues with American capitalism. Interestingly, the baboon study showed increased aggressiveness only in dominant females. Presumably, subordinate females simply couldn't express increased aggressiveness. All these findings suggest that the mood and behavioral shifts are biologically based. What is a social construct is medicalizing and pathologizing these shifts as symptoms, a syndrome or disorder. Thus, what is the underlying biology? A leading theory points to the plunging levels of progesterone as menses approaches, and thus the loss of its anxiolytic and sedating effects. In this view, PMS arises from too extreme of a decline. However, there's not much actual support for this idea. Another theory, backed by some evidence, concerns the hormone beta-endorphin, famed for being secreted during exercise and inducing a gauzy, euphoric runner's high. In this model, PMS is about abnormally low levels of beta-endorphin. There are plenty more theories, but very little certainty. Now for the question of how much PMS is associated with aggression. In the 1960s, studies by Katharina Dalton, who coined the term premenstrual syndrome in 1953, reported that female criminals committed their crimes disproportionately during their paramenstrual period, which may tell less about committing a crime than about getting caught. Other studies of a boarding school showed a disproportionate share of bad marks for behavioral offenses going to paramenstrual students. However, the prison studies didn't distinguish between violent and nonviolent crimes, and the school study didn't distinguish between aggressive acts and infractions like tardiness. Collectively, there is little evidence that women tend toward aggression around their menses or that violent women are more likely to have committed their acts around their menses. Nevertheless, defense pleas of PMS-related diminished responsibility have been successful in courtrooms. A notable 1980 case concerned Sandy Craddock, who murdered a coworker and had a long rap sheet with more than 30 convictions for theft, arson, and assault. Incongruously but fortuitously, Craddock was a meticulous diarist, having years of records of not just when she was having her period, but also when she was out about town on a criminal spree. Her criminal acts and times of menses matched so closely that she was put on probation plus progesterone treatment. And making the case stranger, Craddock's doctor later reduced her progesterone dose. By her next period, she had been arrested for attempting to knife someone. Probation again, plus a wee bit more progesterone. These studies suggest that a small number of women do show paramenstrual behavior that qualifies as psychotic and should be mitigating in a courtroom. Nevertheless, normal garden-variety paramenstrual shifts in mood and behavior are not particularly associated with increased aggression. Stress and imprudent brain function. The time before some of our most important, consequential behaviors can be filled with stress. Which is too bad, since stress influences the decisions we make, rarely for the better. The basic dichotomy of the acute and the chronic stress response. We begin with a long-forgotten term from ninth-grade biology. Remember homeostasis? It means having an ideal body temperature, heart rate, glucose level, and so on. A stressor is anything that disrupts homeostatic balance, say, being chased by a lion if you're a zebra, or chasing after a zebra if you're a hungry lion. The stress response is the array of neural and endocrine changes that occur in that zebra or lion, designed to get them through that crisis and reestablish homeostasis. Critical events in the brain mediate the start of the stress response. Warning, the next two paragraphs are technical and not essential. The sight of the lion activates the amygdala. Amygdaloid neurons stimulate brainstem neurons, which then inhibit the parasympathetic nervous system and mobilize the sympathetic nervous system, releasing epinephrine and norepinephrine throughout the body. The amygdala also mediates the other main branch of the stress response, activating the paraventricular nucleus, PVN, in the hypothalamus. And the PVN sends projections to the base of the hypothalamus, where it secretes corticotropin-releasing hormone, CRH. This triggers the pituitary to release adrenocorticotropic hormone, ACTH, which stimulates glucocorticoid secretion from the adrenals. Glucocorticoids, plus the sympathetic nervous system, enable an organism to survive a physical stressor by activating the classical fight-or-flight response. Whether you are that zebra or that lion, you'll need energy for your muscles, and the stress response rapidly mobilizes energy into circulation from storage sites in your body. Furthermore, heart rate and blood pressure increase, delivering that circulating energy to exercising muscles faster. Moreover, during stress, long-term building projects, growth, tissue repair, and reproduction are postponed until after the crisis. After all, if a lion is chasing you, you have better things to do with your energy than, say, thicken your uterine walls. Beta endorphin is secreted, the immune system is stimulated, and blood clotting is enhanced, all useful following painful injury. Moreover, glucocorticoids reach the brain, rapidly enhancing aspects of cognition and sensory acuity. This is wonderfully adaptive for the zebra or lion. Try sprinting without epinephrine and glucocorticoids, and you'll soon be dead. Reflecting its importance, this basic stress response is ancient physiology found in mammals, birds, fish, and reptiles. What is not ancient Is how stress works in smart, socially sophisticated, recently evolved primates. For primates, the definition of a stressor expands beyond merely a physical challenge to homeostasis. In addition, it includes thinking you're going to be thrown out of homeostasis. An anticipatory stress response is adaptive if there really is a physical challenge coming. However, if you're constantly but incorrectly convinced that you're about to be thrown out of balance, you're being an anxious, neurotic, paranoid, or hostile primate who is psychologically stressed. And the stress response did not evolve for dealing with this recent mammalian innovation. Mobilizing energy while sprinting for your life helps save you. Do the same thing chronically because of a stressful 30-year mortgage, and you're at risk for various metabolic problems, including adult-onset diabetes. Likewise with blood pressure. Increase it to sprint across the savanna, good thing. Increase it because of chronic psychological stress, and you've got stress-induced hypertension. Chronically impair growth and tissue repair, and you'll pay the price. Ditto for chronically inhibiting reproductive physiology. You'll disrupt ovulatory cycles in women and cause plummeting erections and testosterone levels in men. Finally, while the acute stress response involves enhanced immunity, chronic stress suppresses immunity, increasing vulnerability to some infectious diseases. Footnote. More info for aficionados. The suppression of immunity and inflammation during chronic stress is caused by glucocorticoids. This is the reason why glucocorticoids are used to suppress the immune system in people with an overactive immune system, i.e., an autoimmune disease, to prevent rejection of a transplanted organ or to suppress an overactive inflammatory response. This is what happens when people are put on immunosuppressive anti-inflammatory steroids, like cortisone or prednisone, two synthetic glucocorticoids. We have a dichotomy. If you're stressed like a normal mammal in an acute physical crisis, the stress response is life-saving. But if instead you chronically activate the stress response for reasons of psychological stress, your health suffers. It is a rare human who sickens because they can't activate the stress response when it is needed. Instead, we get sick from activating the stress response too often, too long, and for purely psychological reasons. Crucially, the beneficial effects of the stress response for sprinting zebras and lions play out over the course of seconds to minutes. But once you take stress to the time course of this chapter, henceforth referred to as sustained stress, you'll be dealing with adverse consequences, including some unwelcome effects on the behaviors that fill this book. A brief digression. Stress that we love. Either running from a lion or dealing with years of traffic jams is a drag, which contrasts with stress that we love. We love stress that is mild and transient and occurs in a benevolent context. The stressful menace of a roller coaster ride is that it will make us queasy, not that it will decapitate us. It lasts for 3 minutes, not 3 days. We love that kind of stress, clamor for it, pay to experience it. What do we call that optimal amount of stress? Being engaged, engrossed, and challenged. Being stimulated. Playing. The core of psychological stress is loss of control and predictability. But in benevolent settings, we happily relinquish control and predictability to be challenged by the unexpected. A dip in the roller coaster tracks, a plot twist, a difficult line drive heading our way, an opponent's unexpected chess move. Surprise me. This is fun. This brings up a key concept, namely the inverted U. The complete absence of stress is aversively boring. Moderate, transient stress is wonderful. Various aspects of brain function are enhanced. Glucocorticoid levels in that range enhance dopamine release. Rats work at pressing levers in order to be infused with just the right amount of glucocorticoids. And as stress becomes more severe and prolonged, those good effects disappear, with, of course, dramatic individual differences as to where the transition from stress as stimulatory to overstimulatory occurs. One person's nightmare is another's hobby. Footnote. How does the brain pull off an inverted U, where a moderate rise in glucocorticoid levels enhances memory, for example, while a bigger rise does the opposite? One solution that the brain has evolved is to have two receptor systems for glucocorticoids. One, the MR, is responsive to small increases in glucocorticoid levels above baseline and mediates the stimulatory effects. The other, GR, receptors respond only to big, prolonged increases and mediate the adverse effects. Predictably, levels of the two types of receptors vary by brain region, person, and circumstance. We love the right amount of stress, would wither without it. But back now to sustained stress and the right side of the inverted U. Sustained stress and the neurobiology of fear. For starters, sustained stress makes people implicitly, i.e. not consciously, look more at angry faces. Moreover, during stress, that sensory shortcut from the thalamus to the amygdala becomes more active, with more excitable synapses. We know the resulting trade-off between speed and accuracy. Compounding things further, glucocorticoids decrease activation of the cognitive medial PFC during processing of emotional faces. Collectively, stress or glucocorticoid administration decreases accuracy when rapidly assessing emotions of faces. Meanwhile, during stress, things aren't going great in the amygdala. The region is highly sensitive to glucocorticoids, with lots of glucocorticoid receptors. Stress and glucocorticoids increase excitability of amygdaloid neurons, particularly in the basolateral amygdala, the BLA, with its role in learning fear. Thus, this is another contingent hormone action. Glucocorticoids don't cause action potentials in amygdaloid neurons, don't invent excitation. Instead, they amplify pre-existing excitation. Stress and glucocorticoids also increase levels of CRH in the BLA and of a growth factor that builds new dendrites and synapses, brain-derived neurotrophic factor, or BDNF. Recall from Chapter 2 how during a fearful situation, the amygdala recruits the hippocampus into remembering contextual information about the event, e.g., the amygdala remembers the thief's knife, whereas the hippocampus remembers where the robbery occurred. Stress strengthens this recruitment, making the hippocampus a temporary, fear-laden suburb of the amygdala. Thanks to these glucocorticoid actions in the amygdala, stress makes it easier to learn a fear association and to consolidate it into a long-term memory. This sets us up for a positive feedback loop. As noted, with the onset of stress, the amygdala indirectly activates the glucocorticoid stress response. And in turn, glucocorticoids increase amygdala excitability. Stress also makes it harder to unlearn fear, to extinguish a conditioned fear association. This involves the prefrontal cortex, which causes fear extinction by inhibiting the BLA, as covered in Chapter 2. Stress weakens the PFC's hold over the amygdala. Recall what fear extinction is about. You've learned to fearfully associate a light with a shock, but today the light keeps coming on with no shock. Extinction is not passively forgetting that light equals shock. It is the BLA actively learning that light no longer equals shock. Thus, stress facilitates learning fear associations, but impairs learning fear extinction. Sustained stress, executive function, and judgment. Stress compromises other aspects of frontal cortical function. Working memory is disrupted. In one study, prolonged administration of high glucocorticoid levels to healthy subjects impaired working memory into the range seen after frontal cortical damage. Glucocorticoids accomplish this by enhancing norepinephrine signaling in the PFC so much that, instead of causing aroused focus, it induces chicken with its head cut off cognitive tumult, and by enhancing disruptive signaling from the amygdala to the PFC. Stress also desynchronizes activation in different frontocortical regions, which impairs the ability to shift attention between tasks. These stress effects on frontal function also make us perseverative, in a rut, set in our ways, running on automatic, being habitual. We all know this. What do we typically do during a stressful time when something isn't working? The same thing again, many more times, faster and more intensely. It becomes unimaginable that the usual isn't working. This is precisely where the frontal cortex makes you do the harder but more correct thing. Recognize that it's time for a change. Except for a stressed frontal cortex, or one that's been exposed to a lot of glucocorticoids. In rats, monkeys, and humans, stress weakens frontal connections with the hippocampus, essential for incorporating the new information that should prompt shifting to a new strategy, while strengthening frontal connections with more habitual brain circuits. Finally, the decreased frontal function and increased amygdaloid function during stress alter risk-taking behavior. For example, the stress of sleep deprivation or of public speaking or the administration of high glucocorticoid levels shifts people from protecting against losses to seeking bigger gains when gambling. This involves an interesting gender difference. In general, major stressors make people of both genders more risk-taking. But moderate stressors bias men toward, and women away from, risk-taking. In the absence of stress, men tend toward more risk-taking than women. Thus, once again, hormones enhance a pre-existing tendency. Whether one becomes irrationally risk-taking, failing to shift strategy in response to a declining reward rate, or risk-averse, failing to respond to the opposite, one is incorporating new information poorly. Stated most broadly, sustained stress impairs risk assessment. Sustained stress and pro and antisociality. During sustained stress, the amygdala processes emotional sensory information more rapidly and less accurately, dominates hippocampal function, and disrupts frontocortical function. We're more fearful, our thinking is muddled, and we assess risks poorly and act impulsively out of habit, rather than incorporating new data. This is a prescription for rapid, reactive aggression. Stress and acute administration of glucocorticoids increase such aggression in both rodents and humans. We have two familiar qualifications. A. Rather than creating aggression, stress and glucocorticoids increase sensitivity to social triggers of aggression. B. This occurs most readily in individuals already predisposed toward aggression. As we will see in the next chapter, stress over the course of weeks to months produces a less nuanced picture. There's an additional depressing reason why stress fosters aggression, because it reduces stress. Shock a rat and its glucocorticoid levels and blood pressure rise. With enough shocks, it's at risk for a stress ulcer. Various things can buffer the rat during shocks, running on a running wheel, eating, gnawing on wood in frustration. But a particularly effective buffer is for the rat to bite another rat. Stress-induced, aka frustration-induced, displacement aggression is ubiquitous in various species. Among baboons, for example, nearly half of aggression is this type. A high-ranking male loses a fight and chases a sub-adult male, who promptly bites a female, who then lunges at an infant. My research shows that, within the same dominance rank, the more a baboon tends to displace aggression after losing a fight, the lower his glucocorticoid levels. Humans excel at stress-induced displacement aggression. Consider how economic downturns increase rates of spousal and child abuse. Or consider a study of family violence and pro football. If the local team unexpectedly loses, spousal/partner violence by men increases 10% soon afterward, with no increase when the team won or was expected to lose. And as the stakes get higher, the pattern is exacerbated. A 13% increase after upsets when the team was in playoff contention, a 20% increase when the upset is by a rival. Little is known concerning the neurobiology of displacement aggression, blunting the stress response. I'd guess that lashing out activates dopaminergic reward pathways, a surefire way to inhibit CRH release. Far too often, giving an ulcer helps avoid getting one. More bad news. Stress biases us towards selfishness. In one study, subjects answered questions about moral decision-making scenarios after either a social stressor or a neutral situation. Some scenarios were of low emotional intensity. In the supermarket, you wait at the meat counter and an elderly man pushes to the front. Would you complain? Others, high intensity. You meet the love of your life, but you are married and have children. Would you leave your family? Stress made people give more egoistic answers about emotionally intense moral decisions, but not milder ones. The more glucocorticoid levels rose, the more egoistic the answers. Moreover, in the same paradigm, stress lessened how altruistic people claimed they'd be concerning personal, but not impersonal, moral decisions. We have another contingent endocrine effect. Stress makes people more egoistic, but only in the most emotionally intense and personal circumstances. This resembles another circumstance of poor frontal function. Recall from Chapter 2 how individuals with frontal cortical damage make reasonable judgments about someone else's issues, but the more personal and emotionally potent the issue, the more they are impaired. Feeling better by abusing someone innocent or thinking more about your own needs is not compatible with feeling empathy. Does stress decrease empathy? Seemingly yes, in both mice and humans. A remarkable 2006 paper in Science by Jeffrey Mogul of McGill University showed the rudiments of mouse empathy. A mouse's pain threshold is lowered when it is near another mouse in pain, but only if the other mouse is its cage mate. This prompted a follow-up study that I did with Mogul's group involving the same paradigm. The presence of a strange mouse triggers a stress response. But when glucocorticoid secretion is temporarily blocked, mice show the same pain empathy for a strange mouse as for a cage mate. In other words, to personify mice, glucocorticoids narrow who counts as enough of an us to evoke empathy. Likewise in humans, pain empathy was not evoked for a stranger unless glucocorticoid secretion was blocked, either after administration of a short-acting drug or after the subject and stranger interacted socially. Recall from Chapter 2 the involvement of the anterior cingulate cortex in pain empathy. I bet that glucocorticoids do some disabling, atrophying things to neurons there. Thus, sustained stress has some pretty unappealing behavioral effects. Nonetheless, there are circumstances where stress brings out the magnificent best in some people. Work by Shelley Taylor of UCLA shows that fight or flight is the typical response to stress in males, and naturally, the stress literature is predominantly studies of males by males. Things often differ in females. Showing that she can match the good old boys when it comes to snappy sound bites, Taylor framed the female stress response as being more about tend and befriend, caring for your young and seeking social affiliation. This fits with striking sex differences in stress management styles, and tend and befriend most likely reflects the female stress response involving a stronger component of oxytocin secretion. Naturally, things are subtler than male equals fight slash flight and female equals tend slash befriend. There are frequent counterexamples to each. Stress elicits prosociality in more males than just pair-bonded male marmosets, and we saw that females are plenty capable of aggression. Then there's Mahatma Gandhi and Sarah Palin. Why are some people exceptions to these gender stereotypes? That's part of what the rest of this book is about. Stress can disrupt cognition, impulse control, emotional regulation, decision-making, empathy, and prosociality. One final point. Recall from Chapter 2 how the frontal cortex, making you do the harder thing when it's the right thing, is value-free. Right thing is purely instrumental. same with stress. Its effects on decision-making are adverse only in a neurobiological sense. During a stressful crisis, an EMT may become perseverative, making her ineffectual at saving lives, a bad thing. During a stressful crisis, a sociopathic warlord may become perseverative, making him ineffectual at ethnically cleansing a village. Not a bad thing. Some important debunking. Alcohol. No review of the biological events in the minutes to hours prior to a behavior can omit alcohol. As everyone knows, alcohol lessens inhibitions, making people more aggressive. Wrong, and in a familiar way. Alcohol only evokes aggression in A. individuals prone to aggression, for example, mice with lower levels of serotonin signaling in the frontal cortex, and men with the oxytocin receptor gene variant, less responsive to oxytocin, are preferentially made aggressive by alcohol, and B. those who believe that alcohol makes you more aggressive, once more showing the power of social learning to shape biology. Alcohol works differently in everyone else. For example, a drunken stupor has caused many a quickie Vegas wedding that doesn't seem like a great idea with the next day's sunrise. Summary and some conclusions. Hormones are great. They run circles around neurotransmitters in terms of the versatility and duration of their effects, and this includes affecting the behaviors pertinent to this book. Testosterone has far less to do with aggression than most assume. Within the normal range, individual differences in testosterone levels don't predict who will be aggressive. Moreover, the more an organism has been aggressive, the less testosterone is needed for future aggression. When testosterone does play a role, it's facilitatory. Testosterone does not invent aggression. It makes us more sensitive to triggers of aggression, particularly in those most prone to aggression. Also, rising testosterone levels foster aggression only during challenges to status. Finally, crucially, the rise in testosterone during a status challenge does not necessarily increase aggression. It increases whatever is needed to maintain status. In a world in which status is awarded for the best of our behaviors, testosterone would be the most pro-social hormone in existence. Oxytocin and vasopressin facilitate mother-infant bond formation and monogamous pair bonding, decrease anxiety and stress, enhance trust and social affiliation, and make people more cooperative and generous. But this comes with a huge caveat. These hormones increase pro-sociality only toward an us. When dealing with thems, they make us more ethnocentric and xenophobic. Oxytocin is not a universal love hormone. It's a parochial one. Female aggression in defense of offspring is typically adaptive and is facilitated by estrogen, progesterone, and oxytocin. Importantly, females are aggressive in many other evolutionarily adaptive circumstances. Such aggression is facilitated by the presence of androgens in females and by complex neuroendocrine tricks for generating androgenic signals in aggressive but not maternal or affiliative parts of the female brain. Mood and behavioral changes around the time of menses are a biological reality, albeit poorly understood on a nuts-and-bolts level. In contrast, pathologizing these shifts is a social construct. Finally, except for rare, extreme cases, the link between PMS and aggression is minimal. Sustained stress has numerous adverse effects. The amygdala becomes overactive and more coupled to pathways of habitual behavior. It is easier to learn fear and harder to unlearn it. We process emotionally salient information more rapidly and automatically, but with less accuracy. Frontal function, working memory, impulse control, executive decision-making, risk assessment, and task shifting is impaired, and the frontal cortex has less control over the amygdala. And we become less empathic and pro-social. Reducing sustained stress is a win-win for us and those stuck around us. I'd been drinking is no excuse for aggression. Over the course of minutes to hours, hormonal effects are predominantly contingent and facilitative. Hormones don't determine, command, cause, or invent behaviors. Instead, they make us more sensitive to the social triggers of emotionally laden behaviors and exaggerate our pre-existing tendencies in those domains. And where do those pre-existing tendencies come from? From the contents of the chapters ahead of us. Chapter 5. Days to months before. Our act has occurred. The pulling of a trigger, or the touching of an arm that can mean such different things in different contexts. Why did that just happen? We've seen how, seconds before, that behavior was the product of the nervous system, whose actions were shaped by sensory cues minutes to hours before, and how the brain's sensitivity to those cues was shaped by hormonal exposure in the preceding hours to days. What events in the prior days to months shaped that outcome? Chapter 2 introduced the plasticity of neurons, the fact that things alter in them, the strength of a dendritic input, the axon helix set point for initiating an action potential, the duration of the refractory period. The previous chapter showed that, for example, testosterone increases the excitability of amygdaloid neurons, and glucocorticoids decrease excitability of prefrontal cortical neurons. We even saw how progesterone boosts the efficacy with which GABAergic neurons decrease the excitability of other neurons. Those versions of neuroplasticity occur over hours. We now examine more dramatic plasticity occurring over days to months. A few months is enough time for an Arab Spring, for a discontented winter, or for STDs to spread a lot during a summer of love. As we'll see, this is also sufficient time for enormous changes in the brain's structure. Nonlinear excitation. We start small. How can events from months ago produce a synapse with altered excitability today? How do synapses remember? When neuroscientists first approached the mystery of memory at the start of the 20th century, they asked that question on a more macro level. How does a brain remember? Obviously, a memory was stored in a single neuron, and a new memory required a new neuron. The discovery that adult brains don't make new neurons trashed that idea. Better microscopes revealed neuronal arborization, the breathtaking complexity of branches of dendrites and axon terminals. Maybe a new memory requires a neuron to grow a new axonal or dendritic branch. Knowledge emerged about synapses. Neurotransmitterology was born, and this idea was modified. A new memory requires the formation of a new synapse, a new connection between an axon terminal and a dendritic spine. These speculations were tossed on the ash heap of history in 1949, because of the work of the Canadian neurobiologist Donald Hebb, a man so visionary that even now, nearly 70 years later, neuroscientists still own bobblehead dolls of him. In his seminal book, The Organization of Behavior, Hebb proposed what became the dominant paradigm. Forming memories doesn't require new synapses, let alone new branches or neurons. It requires the strengthening of pre-existing synapses. What does strengthening mean? In circuitry terms, if neuron A synapses onto neuron B, it means that an action potential in neuron A more readily triggers one in neuron B. They are more tightly coupled. They remember. Translated into cellular terms, strengthening means that the wave of excitation in a dendritic spine spreads farther, getting closer to the distant axon hillock. Extensive research shows that experience that causes repeated firing across a synapse strengthens it, with a key role played by the neurotransmitter glutamate. Recall from Chapter 2 how an excitatory neurotransmitter binds to its receptor in the postsynaptic dendritic spine, causing a sodium channel to open. Some sodium flows in, causing a blip of excitation, which then spreads. Glutamate signaling works in a fancier way that is essential to learning. To simplify considerably, while dendritic spines typically contain only one type of receptor, those responsive to glutamate contain two. The first, the non-NMDA, works in a conventional way. For every little smidgen of glutamate binding to these receptors, a smidgen of sodium flows in, causing a smidgen of excitation. The second, the NMDA, works in a nonlinear threshold manner. It is usually unresponsive to glutamate. It's not until the non-NMDA has been stimulated over and over by a long train of glutamate release, allowing enough sodium to flow in, that this activates the NMDA receptor. It suddenly responds to all that glutamate, opening its channels, allowing an explosion of excitation. This is the essence of learning. The lecturer says something, and it goes in one ear and out the other. The factoid is repeated, same thing. It's repeated enough times and, aha, the light bulb goes on and suddenly you get it. At a synaptic level, the axon terminal, having to repeatedly release glutamate, is the lecturer droning on repetitively. The moment when the postsynaptic threshold is passed and the NMDA receptors first activate, is the dendritic spine finally getting it. Aha versus actually remembering. But this has only gotten us to first base. The light bulb going on in the middle of the lecture doesn't mean it'll still be on in an hour, let alone during the final exam. How can we make that burst of excitation persist so that NMDA receptors remember are more easily activated in the future? How does the potentiated excitation become long-term? This is our cue to introduce the iconic concept of LTP, long-term potentiation. LTP, first demonstrated in 1966 by Tarja Lomo at the University of Oslo, is the process by which the first burst of NMDA receptor activation causes a prolonged increase in excitability of the synapse. Footnote. Although nothing was known about NMDA and non-NMDA receptors at the time. Hundreds of productive careers have been spent figuring out how LTP works, and the key is that when NMDA receptors finally activate and open their channels, it is calcium rather than sodium that flows in. This causes an array of changes. Here are a few. The calcium tidal wave causes more copies of glutamate receptors to be inserted into the dendritic spine's membrane, making the neuron more responsive to glutamate thereafter. Footnote. Where do more copies of the receptors come from? Miles away from that dendritic spine, in the center of that neuron, is the nucleus, containing the DNA, which includes genes coding for glutamate receptors. Somehow, the nucleus needs to hear that a calcium wave occurred in one dendritic spine in the boondocks. The nucleus then directs the synthesis of more copies of the receptor, which are then shipped to that specific spine, out of the neuron's 10,000. That's insanely hard. Typically, instead, there are extra glutamate receptors mothballed inside dendritic spines, and the calcium tidal wave is the signal that pulls them onto the spine's membrane. The calcium also alters glutamate receptors that are already on the front lines of that dendritic spine. Each will now be more sensitive to glutamate signals. Footnote. For aficionados, the non-NMDA receptors are phosphorylated, which causes their sodium channels to stay open longer. The calcium also causes the synthesis of peculiar neurotransmitters in the dendritic spine, which are released and travel backward across the synapse. There, they increase the amount of glutamate released from the axon terminal after future action potentials. In other words, LTP arises from a combination of the presynaptic axon terminal yelling glutamate more loudly and the postsynaptic dendritic spine listening more attentively. As I said, additional mechanisms underlie LTP, and neuroscientists debate which is most important, the one they study, naturally, in neurons in organisms when they are actually learning, In general, the debate has been whether pre- or the postsynaptic changes are more crucial. After LTP came a discovery that suggests a universe in balance. This is LTD, long-term depression. Experience-dependent, long-term decreases in synaptic excitability. And interestingly, the mechanisms underlying LTD are not merely the opposite of LTP. LTD is not the functional opposite of LTP either. Rather than being the basis of generic forgetting, it sharpens a signal by erasing what's extraneous. A final point about LTP. There's long-term and there's long-term. As noted, one mechanism underlying LTP is an alteration in glutamate receptors so that they are more responsive to glutamate. That change might persist for the lifetime of the copies of that receptor that were in that synapse at the time of the LTPing. But that's typically only a few days until those copies accumulate bits of oxygen radical damage and are degraded and replaced with new copies. Similar updating of all proteins constantly occurs. Somehow, LTP-induced changes in the receptor are transferred to the next generation of copies. How else can octogenarians remember kindergarten? The mechanism is elegant, but beyond the scope of this chapter. All this is cool, but LTP and LDP are what happens in the hippocampus when you learn explicit facts, like someone's phone number. But we're interested in other types of learning. How we learn to be afraid, to control our impulses, to feel empathy, or to feel nothing for someone else. Synapses utilizing glutamate occur throughout the nervous system, and LTP isn't exclusive to the hippocampus. This was a traumatic discovery for many LTP/hippocampus researchers. After all, LTP is what occurred in Schopenhauer's hippocampus when he read Hegel, not what the spinal cord does to make you more coordinated at twerking. Footnote. Actually, LTP in the spinal cord has more to do with neuropathic pain, syndromes where a severe injury causes all sorts of non-noxious stimuli to start hurting chronically. In effect, your spine has learned to always feel pain. Interestingly, such LTP arises in part from the inflammation that accompanies the initial injury. Nonetheless, LTP occurs throughout the nervous system. For example, fear conditioning involves synapses LTPing in the basolateral amygdala. LTP underlies the frontal cortex learning to control the amygdala. It's how dopaminergic systems learn to associate a stimulus with a reward. For example, how addicts come to associate a location with a drug, feeling cravings when in that setting. Let's add hormones to this, translating some of our stress concepts into the language of neuroplasticity. Moderate, transient stress, i.e. the good, stimulatory stress, promotes hippocampal LTP, while prolonged stress disrupts it and promotes LTD, one reason why cognition tanks at such times. This is the inverted U concept of stress writ synaptic. Moreover, sustained stress and glucocorticoid exposure enhance LTP and suppress LTD in the amygdala, boosting fear conditioning, and suppress LTP in the frontal cortex. Combining these effects, more excitable synapses in the amygdala, fewer ones in the frontal cortex, helps explain stress-induced impulsivity and poor emotional regulation. Rescued from the trash. The notion of memory resting on the strengthening of pre-existing synapses dominates the field. But ironically, the discarded idea that memory requires the formation of new synapses has been resuscitated. Techniques for counting all of a neuron's synapses show that housing rats in a rich, stimulatory environment increases their number of hippocampal synapses. Profoundly fancy techniques let you follow one dendritic branch of a neuron over time as a rat learns something. Astonishingly, over minutes to hours, a new dendritic spine emerges, followed by an axon terminal hovering nearby. Over the next weeks, they form a functioning synapse that stabilizes the new memory. And in other circumstances, dendritic spines retract, eliminating synapses. Such activity-dependent synaptogenesis is coupled to LTP, When a synapse undergoes LTP, the tsunami of calcium rushing into the spine can diffuse and trigger the formation of a new spine in the adjacent stretch of the dendritic branch. New synapses form throughout the brain, in motor cortex neurons when you learn a motoric task, or in the visual cortex after lots of visual stimulation. Stimulate a rat's whiskers a lot, and ditto in the whisker cortex. Moreover, when enough new synapses form in a neuron, the length and number of branches in its dendritic tree often expand as well, increasing the strength and number of the neurons that can talk to it. Stress and glucocorticoids have inverted U effects here as well. Moderate transient stress, or exposure to the equivalent glucocorticoid levels, increases spine number in the hippocampus. Sustained stress, or glucocorticoid exposure, does the opposite. Moreover, major depression or anxiety, two disorders associated with elevated glucocorticoid levels, can reduce hippocampal dendrite and spine number. This arises from decreased levels of that key growth factor mentioned earlier in this chapter, BDNF. Sustained stress and glucocorticoids also cause dendritic retraction and synapse loss. Lower levels of NCAM, a neural cell adhesion molecule that stabilizes synapses, and less glutamate release in the frontal cortex. The more of these changes, the more attentional and decision-making impairments. Recall from Chapter 4 how acute stress strengthens connectivity between the frontal cortex and motoric areas while weakening frontal hippocampal connections. The result is decision-making that is habitual, rather than incorporating new information. Similarly, chronic stress increases spine number in frontal motor connections and decreases it in frontal hippocampal ones. Continuing the theme of the amygdala differing from the frontal cortex and hippocampus, sustained stress increases BDNF levels and expands dendrites in the BLA, persistently increasing anxiety and fear conditioning. The same occurs in that way station by which the amygdala talks to the rest of the brain, the BNST, bed nucleus of the stria terminalis. Recall that while the BLA mediates fear conditioning, the central amygdala is more involved in innate phobias. Interestingly, stress seems not to increase the force of phobias or spine number in the central amygdala. There's wonderful context dependency to these effects. When a rat secretes tons of glucocorticoids because it's terrified, dendrites atrophy in the hippocampus. However, if it secretes the same amount by voluntarily running on a running wheel, dendrites expand. Whether the amygdala is also activated seems to determine whether the hippocampus interprets the glucocorticoids as good or bad stress. Spine number and branch length in the hippocampus and frontal cortex are also increased by estrogen. Remarkably, the size of neurons' dendritic trees in the hippocampus expands and contracts like an accordion throughout a female rat's ovulatory cycle, with the size, and her cognitive skills, peaking when estrogen peaks. Footnote. Equally remarkably, over the course of the menstrual cycle in humans, the amount of myelin in the corpus callosum, the massive bundle of axons that connects the two hemispheres, fluctuates as well. Thus, neurons can form new dendritic branches and spines, increasing the size of their dendritic tree, or in other circumstances, do the opposite. Hormones frequently mediate these effects. Axonal plasticity. Meanwhile, there's plasticity at the other end of the neuron, where axons can sprout offshoots that head off in novel directions. As a spectacular example, when a blind person adept at Braille reads in it, there's the same activation of the tactile cortex as in anyone else. But amazingly, uniquely, there is also activation of the visual cortex. In other words, neurons that normally send axons to the fingertip processing part of the cortex instead have gone miles off course, growing projections to the visual cortex. One extraordinary case concerned a congenitally blind woman adept at Braille who had a stroke in her visual cortex. And as a result, she lost the ability to read Braille. The bumps on the page felt flattened, imprecise, while other tactile functions remained. In another study, blind subjects were trained to associate letters with distinctive tones, to the point where they could hear a sequence of tones as letters and words. When these individuals would read with sound, they'd activate the part of the visual cortex activated in sighted individuals when reading. Similarly, when a person who is deaf and adept at American Sign Language watches someone signing, there is activation of the part of their auditory cortex normally activated by speech. The injured nervous system can remap in similar ways. Suppose there is stroke damage to the part of your cortex that receives tactile information from your hand. The tactile receptors in your hand work fine, but have no neurons to talk to. Thus, you lose sensation in your hand. In the subsequent months to years, axons from those receptors can sprout off in new directions, shoehorning their way into neighboring parts of the cortex, forming new synapses there. An imprecise sense of touch may slowly return to the hand, along with a less precise sense of touch in the part of the body projecting to the cortical region that accommodated those refugee axon terminals. Suppose, instead, that tactile receptors in the hand are destroyed, no longer projecting to those sensory cortical neurons. Neurons abhor a vacuum, and tactile neurons in the wrist may sprout collateral axonal branches and expand their territory into that neglected cortical region.